The Guardian.
Eurasia! Welcome to Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Paul McInnes, and riding towards us on the wings of a dove are the following. Anti-folk head honcho Jeffrey Lewis. He goes to bed with Tim Jones. We do Metronomy, Sigur Rós, and yes, Glen Campbell in Singles Club. Rosie will be showing and telling one of her favourite acts, and we'll have all the usual face backery. But first, to Glasgow. That's the sound of Las Vegas, the band who are set to release perhaps the most anticipated debut album of the year. There are four pieces from the mean streets of Glasgow who've managed to update Phil Spector's Wall of Sound for 2008 by twinning it with ginormous echoing guitars and songs about stabbings and sectarianism. I met with songwriter James Allen and guitarist Rab Allen, their cousins, earlier this week. We were in a swanky hotel. You need to know that before the conversation starts. Things must be a little bit of a whirl for you right now. I mean, you've been on the radar, the music radar, for, you know, a year, and you've been playing lots and lots of gigs. But the last few months, things have just accelerated as you've come towards the release of your debut album. How has that been for you?
It spins your head, you know, and just when you think things can't get more psychedelic and bloody, then they just get much more psychedelic and bloody, and it's like that day to day. There's certain things you kind of lose perspective on, and yet I'm trying to kind of cling on to that in a lot of ways, you know what I mean? I know if it's like, you know when it's daytime, you know it's nighttime, but you don't know what day it is. And I know what happened yesterday, kind of, and I've got a rough idea of what I'm going to be doing tomorrow, but out with that, on either side, I've not got a clue, you know? I'm trying to hold on to the sense of clarity. And it's evading me quite regularly. I'm sitting with a Banana Bliss cocktail saying that, so I've got a bit of a cheek.
Well, this is what I was going to go on to, is that how much of this, we're sitting in an international hotel right now, in the international bar, looking at £10.50 burgers. How much of this lifestyle do you find kind of just a little bit appealing, or how much of it repels you?
I think it's fine. You just kind of go with it, don't you? There's not really much. I'd rather be sitting here than sitting in McDonald's.
Because it's a better quality of burger.
Of course, aye, that's the only
right. Well, that's perfectly natural to feel that way.
Of course, yeah.
It must be quite a natural instinct, a human being, a lot of time, but I feel that anyway. It's just that you just go with things, and it's just kind of carrying you along, man. You know what I mean? It's kind of blowing you along, man. You're just kind of blown in, and there's an element of that, no kind of fighting against certain things, trying to kind of, you know, stay afloat a bit, you know what I mean?
So is it the case that you miss home, or you're kind of glad to be... glad to escape?
Even home's changing, though. I don't look at home with the same eyes as what I did 4 months ago, 5 months ago. Even being back in Glasgow the other day, I'm looking at the streets in a different light, almost, you know what I mean? But, you know, the tranquility, or just the you know, walking down the street, that's different. And in a good way, you know. I meet lots of kind of great, beautiful people, man, you know what I mean? That are lovely people, man, you know. It's a good human thing. Then there comes the other side that's maybe a bit more difficult as well, you know what I mean? Who the fuck drink you all with sunglasses on? Things are changing, man, you know? And I would say, well, swing towards the positive, you know what I mean? A lot of it is this pure rock and roll, what's happening right now. And it's great, and I love it, man. I feel really good about that, but...
Do you think that by being friends and spending time together, that enabled you to actually make the music where you might not have done otherwise?
I think there's a trust between the four of us. That means that we can do whatever we want, and we each respect it, you know. Like, if James brings a song in, he knows that we'll be honest and respect that, you know. And it's like, he brings a song in, song's there, it's a great song, and then there's a bit of trust there as well. And then I guess when it's the four of us, we can kind of do anything then, you know. There's nothing that we can't do.
Some of the nights I can think back to over the years, it's been some mad nights that we've spent just listening to Oasis in Groot in the streets. You know, I always think about the times like New Year, that when you had that jacket on, and I had the jacket on, with two jackets on, like, well, one jacket each, and then like, the pockets in it, one of these jackets, we had an Oasis jacket, probably, all the pockets in it. You can fit a can of beer in every pocket, man. And walking about, like, it was like an armour, a tenants. If somebody had a shot, mate, you'd have seen the tenants kind of pulling out. No, like, pulling out.
They'd be like, we've got him.
There'd be like bullet holes everywhere in the tenants, man. You know what I mean? I'd been quite invincible. But, and spending the nights kind of walking the streets when it was dark, and just kind of staring into space with a can of beer and walking and talking about rock and roll music, you know what I mean, and talking about things that made us excited and just talking about life in general. You'd be talking about girls or whatever, you know, and just being quite oblivious to your own limitations as well can help.
Something to your music, the sound is really rich and beautiful and cinematic, and yet it's kind of contrasted with subject matter that's almost unrelentingly bleak. Does that contrast kind of apply to how you see your hometown, your experience of growing up, and what informed your music?
I think it was just quite simply things that had been on my mind a lot. Like, if I was more numb, maybe those things wouldn't have played my mind for so long. Putting yourself in other people's positions and, you know what I mean, and just kind of feeling somebody else's pain kind of thing, you know what I mean? I think some of the songs is just, it's through maybe some of that sometimes, you know?
And musically, Rav, how does it work to combine the lyrics, the kind of very realist lyrics sometimes, with that big soundscape?
You know, sometimes what I do, well, what I do is, like, I record doing the demos at home, let the band hear it, the drums and stuff like that, and the bass and stuff, you know what I mean? At the beginning, when we first get together, first try to express these, communicate with each other, like through musical know-how. I mean, some of the ways we communicate, man, it's like it's not like standard musical notation or like terms and
a bit more staccato in that. It's not, you
it's
know
not like it's that kind of shit, man. You know what I mean? It's, we talk about sometimes dreamy or just, I say, like, but kind of like more sugary. You know what I mean? There's more things like that kind of thing. Make it more sugary and sweet or whatever. And then he'll be like, right, cool, and I'll be like, no, more, and he'll be like, more like fucking what? And at one point I was like, fuck this, fuck you, and it'll be like that kind of thing, and it'll be like 5 a.m. in New York City, and I'll be like,
so
how did we fucking get
shot like, fuck off, this is my ass, I'm not doing that again.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your interest in Phil Spector and how you might kind of came to mix this real kind of large rock sensibility with the soul pop?
Well, I remember at one point, like when Phil Spector, when he started like kind of being an influence in my life, his music, not him personally, I don't know him, but his music. It was at one point where I actually had to move house and I had no house to go to, and my mum had just moved house, so she was giving that house up in a couple of weeks, so I moved back to that house. And I remember just it being really shit, man. I didn't know what I was doing, man, all that crap. And I had no power in the house, and I was like, fuck, get your power cards and all that shit. Get power cards, and all I had in the house at that time was, like, you know, like, maybe a bit of dinner and this Phil Spector box set, and there was my mum's CD player was still there. I remember putting it on. I had a little 4-track thing at the time as well, but I remember like listening to that, and it made me feel so fucking euphoric, man. And man, I think that's one of the beauties of rock and roll music, man. You know, when there's some bollocks, man, that's happening in your life, and that kind of really kind of drags you away from that, man, and puts you in this other place, man, where you're kind of lost in some music, you know. And that's a lot of my memories feel like when I first started loving Phil Spector's music. And I guess we chose not to join an orchestra, we chose just to fucking make a band. But then I guess that was what we were trying to do with the guitars, you know. It was more of a kind of like an orchestral thing. I find that can be quite, you can get the kind of results of something quite furious and quite hard hitting, you know. And I guess that was with the echo on the guitars, that's, you know, that was kind of some of the ideas and some of the influence, you know what I mean.
And it also creates a theatrical backdrop for the stories you're telling.
Yeah, it does. It's a sense of drama, you know, and you can push that button, I guess, when you want to kick it into fifth gear, you know what I mean? Sometimes it can punch really hard, you know.
That was James and Rav from Glass Vegas, and their debut album, called Glass Vegas, is out next Monday. I'm joined in the studio by Man About Town and the bloke who made Glass Vegas. Made them, I tell you, Mr. Tim Jones.
Literally made them.
Literally made them out of clay and Adam's spare rib.
Exactly.
Wow.
I invented them with test tubes.
You are crazy. You're like Dr. Yakub in the 5-cent nation of Islam or something like that. We did discuss this years and years ago when you're back in the pod about your involvement with Glass Vegas, and we ribbed you about it then. But now that they're really successful, I think it might be worth you just explaining your role to the listeners a little bit, because you were there right at the V start.
When I met them, they had some demos on their MySpace. Alan McGee was already raving about them. Other than that, no labels really cared about them, and the press didn't care about them at all, because as a journalist, I was trying to pitch to, you know, various magazines, and they were, say what, we don't really care.
Why do you think they weren't interested then but are so keen now? Because...
Well, it was just really interesting being behind the scenes, actually, because you did see that once there was a little bit of press interest and a little bit of hype, then everyone else followed, and it really did happen that quickly. Having said that, there was a few journalists who really liked it as soon as they heard it, and that's what triggers it off, and it's interesting to see it from, you know, being desperate for this band to be written about because I'm helping them.
And super passionate about them too. Now, listening to the album now, what differences can you hear in the sound between now and the period when you were working with them?
Well, I did always like their really rough edges, and obviously some of that had to go. At the same time, the sound's so much more complex, and there's so much more going on with what Rich Costey's done with the production. When they play live now, they've taken on some of these techniques as well, so there's a real kind of psychedelic, quite gothic, swirling noises going around the stage, and it's a lot more powerful to a bigger crowd. I think he's basically taught them how to play to a bigger crowd.
Interesting. And criminally, I didn't ask how you were. Are you actually in good health?
I'm very ill.
You're very ill? No. I wish I didn't ask now.
I'm fine.
Oh, good. Glad to hear that. We'll have a momentary pause, because now it's time to move on to Singles Club. Hey, it's Singles Club. And in the studio with us this week is the guide's Will Dean. Dean.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm happy to be back.
Happy to be back. Yeah, you were around while I was away on holiday, huh?
I was, and, thought I'd fluffed it, but, you know, I've...
But obviously not.
I've blagged my way back in again.
Either that or the panel of pundits is that small that we're going to come round to you very quickly. I'm sure that's not the case. Today it's an all-male lineup, so I would like people not to get too...
Testosterone-fueled.
Do you want me to stop wrestling Will?
Yeah, exactly. Particularly with that lock you've got on him there, it's not a very nice one. And if we had a webcam in here, we wouldn't be able to show the pictures. Anyway, music. This is Metronomy with Heartbreaker. I heard you broke your heart again, so now you're gonna come and see me. We're back to the start again. When she gonna set me free? I've been there time and time again. The girls. Metronomy are either a three-piece electronica act or just the one bloke, Joe Mount. That depends on whether you believe the publicity shots, three people, or what everyone says. It's really just Joe. Imagine the band as the electronica wing of groups like Foals and These New Puritans, or alternatively, the indie wing of Just East-inspired electronica. Hailing from Devon, Metronomy's upcoming album is called Nights Out, which means the Yates Wine Lodge in Teignmouth could well get a mention. Now, Will Dean, you are recommending this track this week, which means A, you like it, but B, you've probably also recently been interviewing Metronomy and therefore well acquainted with
good
their catalogue.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I love the album. I think it's out next week and this single is around then as well. I think you were more right with your second assessment that they're kind of an indie version of Justice. And I think how it works with Metronomy is in the studio, it's just Joe Mount and then the other two guys just join in for live duties.
Live, yeah. They used to be called Food Groups from what I hear.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were his backing band, but now they're fully incorporated.
And yeah, I mentioned this to them when I interviewed them, that I think it's interesting that there's an air of melancholy and emotion in current dance music that's kind of shifted from indie guitar music in the last few years, and that's where the most interesting stuff is happening. And their reaction was, well, you know, that's just good pop music throughout the ages. And to be fair, they're probably kind of right. And I think Heartbreaker is a great example of this. It's quite whimsical. It's part of a story that's told throughout the album of just a really bad weekend of going out and going clubbing and going out and things go wrong. Yeah, I just think it's really terrific. And I think it's got huge crossover potential if it gets the chance, which I'm not entirely sure it will.
Tim, do you see crossover potential with your aptitude for making tips for the top?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I think it's... What I like about it is it's not just mixing sort of dance music and indie music. It's also mixing a real sense of like organic sounds and really twangy instruments. There's a lot of good twanging guitar on that record with, you know, forward-thinking, computerised music. I think if you want to have a hit sort of club record, it's good to get Joe in.
I really like this song. It grew on me the more I listened to it, and I like the atonal elements and the way they kind of actually mesh together and grow throughout the song. But there isn't anything that catchy in it, I didn't think.
Yeah, I can see your point. I mean, I think Radio Ladio, one of the older singles, is kind of catchy, but it isn't a massive pop record, but it is a very likeable pop record. And I think, as you say, you know, you've listened to it a few times and it's grown on you, and you just kind of hope that people will get the chance to listen to it more than once on Radio 1.
Is it likely to be played more than once on Radio 1?
Probably not, no.
Well, anyway, we'll all concur with the sentiment that people should listen to it more. You can actually do that by buying it, because Heartbreaker is out now and the album is out next week, 8th of September. Second track on Singles Club is Inni Mer Singor Vitli Singor by Sigur Rós. Oh, yes. That's Sigur Rós with, shall I really say this again? It begins Inni and then there's three other words. It's a long one. You won't make a mistake when you see it. Sigur Rós are Iceland's third biggest export after fish and also fish products. Despite making music with a touch of the orchestral about it, the band have only one member with any musical training, keyboardist Kjartan Sveinsson. This track is taken from their fifth studio album, oh God, Meisu I Eirum I Spilum Endalost, which features their first English language song called All Right. Somebody should have told them they didn't need the second all. Right, I chose this one, and here's for why. Sigur Rós are the Coldplay it's okay to like. They make big, bombastic, uplifting music, but, and I'll venture this may prove contentious, because they sing in foreign, they're considered to be a little bit arty and are described using terms like post-rock rather than, say, stadium rock, which might be just as appropriate. If there had been any sunshine whatsoever this summer, I would have been out in my garden leaping around to this. It's that upbeat a tune. It's like a constant crescendo, and I think it benefits from having its main melody belted out on a piano that sounds like it's about to break. Tim Jones, would you agree with me?
Yeah, I do agree with you. I think
every single word.
Every single word, and I've got nothing else to say.
Okay, let's wrap this up.
I think the idea that they're labelled as pretentious just because they sing in a foreign language, probably I don't quite agree with.
I wouldn't say they're labelled as pretentious. I would say they are afforded a degree of artistic consideration, which bands like Coldplay aren't.
But I think that's more to do with the fact that they record 17-minute songs that sound like, you know, mating whales. But this is, like you said, this could be up there with, I'd say, more Arcade Fire, that kind of thing, a more pop thing. And I like the fact that it's 4 minutes and just keep building and building. There's lots of uplifting. It makes you feel like you've won the Olympics.
Doesn't it? Although a nice Olympics, an Olympics where kind of cuddling is a competitive sport or something rather than javelin. Will?
I also liked it. There's a bit of a consensus.
We've got three blokes on here. We're going to have wrestling.
This is what happens when we bring in music we like. Next week's got to be music we despise.
I kind of thought I might say something aggressive about Sigur Rós and you all might go, whoa, 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 whoa. But actually, by kind of hedging it in complimentary terms.
Okay. Well, I hate it.
Good.
No, I mean, I do like it. When I first listened to the record, I'd heard it described as Sigur Rós's OK Computer moment, and to which you immediately think, oh, really? And I was a little bit disappointed with the record, but I mean, the track, can I just call it the single?
Because yes, you can do that rather than having to pronounce the name.
It's not so good. It's really upbeat. It's a really happy song. It's the kind of song you can imagine. I mean, the headline Latitude this year, it's probably the only other song of theirs, along with the one off Planet Earth, that everyone would have known and gone bananas to. But, you know, it's chirpy, it's nice, it's what Sigur Rós do well.
I think if it makes BBC drop that ident as well.
Are they still showing it? That's what I love about Sigur Rós, though, is that they were this kind of quite out there band, and now they're just known as the polar bear music.
Right. Blah, Blah, Blah by Sigur Rós is out as a single on September the 8th, but you can buy the song itself right now as part of the album, which is one of these things you can do digitally. Final track on Singles Club is These Days by Glen Campbell. The chance to stop my rambling. I don't do too much gambling these days. These days. That's Glen Campbell with These Days. As well as inventing Campbell's soup and giving birth to England International's Sol, Glen Campbell is an iconic country musician. He sang such classics as Rhinestone Cowboy and Wichita Lineman, played with everyone from Elvis to Sinatra, had songs written for him by Brian Wilson, and was asked personally by John Wayne to appear in True Grit. Other than that, not a lot to say. Oh, this track is a cover of Jackson Browne's These Days, and it's taken from Campbell's album of contemporary covers. It's his 59th album, don't you know? Timbo.
I chose this, and it's probably not the best way to make your debut, picking out the cool, hot record of the time.
Hey, but maybe you're being deliberately counterintuitive, you know, and maybe that's the cooler way to go about it.
It is definitely not a cool record. And growing up, I loved Glen Campbell, especially Galveston, which I used to listen to as a wee bairn.
But like really wee, like when you were six?
Yeah.
You used to put on Glen Campbell?
Yeah, I did. So I have to admit, I haven't been keeping up to date with everything that he's been doing in the last...
Album's 45 to 59, kind of patch you by a little bit.
I remember opening it on the Guardian Music desk, and everyone was a bit confused, and we didn't actually know if it was real, because he's also covered Sing by Travis and Good Riddance, Time of Your Life by Green Day. And he's also done Jesus by the Velvet Underground. It looked quite confusing. We're like, has Glen Campbell really done this? Or is this some kind of wacky joke? But then I played it, and it's not over schmaltzy. His voice is so beautiful still. And this song in particular, you know, Jackson Browne wrote it when he was, you know, I don't know exactly, but 22 or 23, and gave it to Nico to perform on Chelsea Girl. From that perspective, it has a different message. Now, I mean, the whole song's about almost like regrets and how you've got no time left to do the things that you may have wished you'd done. So coming from a 72-year-old man, it's got an extra sort of resonance.
It's a beautiful melody in the original, or in the Nico version, which I'm vaguely familiar with. And in this, he's just made it richer. And you think he's taken off some of the starker edges of it. But
definitely,
he's made it richer in a way as well.
Because Nico couldn't really sing. And I think she's one of the best vocalists in music. But she couldn't sing that well. I mean, she just had a very deep Germanic voice. So it's great to hear it, just such a different take on it.
Will?
I'm going to break the consensus properly this time.
At last.
I was a bit disappointed to find it wasn't Bon Jovi's 1996 hit These Days.
I'm saving that for album 83.
I mean, it's a great song. It's not too bad a cover, but I think what makes the Johnny Cash records, American Recordings, and Neil Diamond when he went back to work with Rick Rubin, they recreated these songs in their own mould, whereas... I mean, especially if you listen to Glen Campbell covering Sing and Times Like These by Foo Fighters, it just, to me, sounds like a kind of comedy covers album. And especially weird on Sing, sorry, I know this isn't the song we're talking about, he tried to sing like Fran Healy, which is really strange. I mean, the whole point of these records is to do them, you know, as Glen Campbell reinterpreting them. And the whole album, to me, just sounds like him. I'm just going to, you know, play a bit of Travis.
I think it'd be quite cynical if he'd got Rick Rubin in, though, and done that thing. And what I like about it is it isn't particularly cool, and it's not going to do for Glen Campbell what it did for Johnny Cash. But I think there's a couple of songs on it that really I find quite moving. And Jesus is another one, especially as that song was written by a band of smacked out, sex-obsessed druggies.
Because that's Jesus was what we were originally going to talk about, and I was very much going to come in on the Dino tip on that one, because I just thought it was anodyne. It was not a reinterpretation. It was almost without interpretation. It was just like he was playing a standard. And whereas this, I think, because it is this formerly roughly hewn melody, which he's just kind of put a little layer of syrup on top and enriched by doing so, I think I can see that. But yeah, I don't get any sense of these songs being chosen because they're appropriate to him or he has something to invest in them. It's just almost like people have gone, all right, okay, well, maybe we need a little bit of Green Day in here to appeal to the punks and we'll get the Brits in with Travis or something, I don't know. But this one actually worked for me. Anyway, what's the name of the album?
Well, hilariously, it's called Meet Glen Campbell.
Meet Glen Campbell.
Is that with an A or two E's?
It'll be one or the other. But yeah, if you missed him on the previous 58, now's your chance to meet Glen Campbell. The album's out now, and therefore you can now download These Days as well. Quick roundup of your feedback on the blog from last week's tracks. Professor Wee Too said the new Fujiya Miyagi record is superb disposable pop. Can something be superb when it's disposable? I don't know. Those cameras are undubitably shit. Rosie's right in that Knickerbocker is effectively a carbon copy of ankle injuries. Paul, pipe down with your lazy referencing. That was my best referencing yet. I put loads of effort into that. They may be flogging an old formula, this is Professor Weetu again, but the nonsensical lyrics provide enough novelty to forgive their stagnant output. I disagree. Anyway, Martin Cooling is back. The Matt Helders rework of the Roots Maneuver track is hot. It really buffs up an otherwise bland effort. See what he's doing there from Mr. Maneuver. I'm definitely looking forward to more remixes from him. Consequently, I'm also trying to book him for a DJ set, but for the life of me, can't find his representation or a suitable means of contact. Grr, he writes, as if thinking we might help him out on that front. Yeah, well, think again, Mr. Cooling. Finally, Ramolution. The Roots Maneuver Matt Helders remix is undoubtedly the best single to be featured in Singles Club in 2008. And, as Rosie has alluded to, it indicates there being a sizable power behind Alex Turner's throne. Mwah! So, we want your reviews of this week's tracks, Glenn Campbell, Metronomy and Sigur Rós. You can post your thoughts at blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. And we're also open for opinions on the following. Chris Brown, Kiss Kiss. I'm a country boy from Tappahannock. VA is where I reside, so shoddy understanding. And I know I just turned 18 and I get a lot. Mogwai, Fat Cat.
You are with crazy ideas.
Shia Shesh, Wolf. Zooton, what's your problem? That was your montage. Thanks to Will of the Dean for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure, as always.
As always. What I promise you, what we will try and do is expand the rota a little bit.
It's fine.
So you don't
feel
like you're being overtapped for opinion. Because, you know,
I have a limited quota of opinion.
I'm glad you saved it. I'm glad you saved your controversial one for last, though, because that really gave us a little bit of an oomph. And that's also it for this week's Singles Club. But you can catch the texticular version of it every Wednesday at guardian.co.uk/music. Next on Music Weekly.
Mussolini had ideas from the confusion of his heart. Then there were a thousand more waiting to play their part. The stage was set, the costumes worn, and another empire of destruction born in another's name.
That is the incomparable sound of Jeffrey Lewis, leading light of the anti-folk movement and author of the Chelsea Hotel oral sex song. Smart, sarky and original, he may not have sold many records, but his influence is grand. So no surprises that Tim Jones is a fan. We sent him to interview Lewis when he was in London, and Jones started by asking about the artwork that bedecks Lewis's live show.
Wearing raver-type suits and a girl wearing glasses who looked kind of cute. Her hair was short and curly. She had a tattoo on her back, which I could see because her red shirt was sleeveless with straps. But I only saw this later, not in my first glance, but I could hear her talking behind me. And as if by
my primary goal this week is to finally finish the artwork for the Complete History of Communism in North Korea, which I've finally finished writing the song for. I just have to do the art, and that'll be my new low budget video as soon as I get that wrapped up.
Okay, so just to explain to all the listeners, what is a low-budget video at a Jeffrey Lewis show? Because it's, you know, quite a unique thing that you do.
Well, it's been something I've been doing for a few years, because I draw comic books. I've been really into making comic books for years and years and years. And once I started making music, I was coming up with different ways to combine these two interests. And one of the ways was to make these things that I call low-budget videos, where I have these sort of giant full-color drawings. You know, it's kind of like these comic books that I'm showing while I'm singing certain songs. Because a lot of my material has a sort of narrative quality to it anyway, a kind of beginning, a middle, and an end. So doing these illustrations to go along with the lyrics, it kind of becomes this sort of film happening live on stage. And since we've been playing these larger shows the last couple years, a lot of times I'll switch from showing the actual artwork to using this little digital projector that I bought secondhand so that the images are projected large behind us. which makes it kind of a different thing. It's not quite as charming as when I'm holding up these big raggedy books, but the projections do preserve them. So, I mean, I've got about 30 of these illustrated songs now.
And what, give us an example of some of the ones you do. I mean, I know there's the illustrated history of communism, isn't there?
Yeah, that's been a big ongoing project. You know, every year I sort of try to complete a new chapter of that. I imagine it might be about maybe 9 chapters in total. And like I say, I finally finished writing chapter 5, which is communism in North Korea. Chapter 4, which I've been doing all last year, is communism in China. And it's just a topic that I've been interested in my whole life. And I knew more about the Russian stuff, but I hadn't really known much about, you know, North Korea or China or, you know, whatever the next chapters are going to be. So it's sort of like giving myself a school assignment. You know, I have to, like, do the research and do a book report and present it to the class. But the class happens to be my audience, which I suppose is the same in a university setting anyway. They just, the purchase price of the tickets for university is kind of just a little more roundabout. Some of the other ones are just fiction, weird stories. The Creeping Brain has been a popular one the last year or so. And some of them are songs of mine that are on my albums that just make sense with illustrations. But a lot of them are just kind of not an album tracks, just sort of their own low-budget video experiences that haven't really found their way into...
I think it's fair to say you don't get, you know, illustrated history of communism in a typical Pigeon Detectives gig. Do you think you could tell us a little bit about the way you go on tour? Because it's very unusual, really. I mean, it's very DIY, isn't it? And a lot of, you know, I've seen you at gigs saying, has anyone got a floor I can sleep on tonight? And can anyone give us a lift to the next city?
Well, that's relatively easy as a solo act. And then there've been tours where, you know, if the band is 4 or 5 people, or sometimes if, you know, a bunch of other people are all on tour with us, and you start asking the audience, who's got room on their floor for 11 or 12 people tonight? You know, it raises the challenge level. But I'm always surprised that people are so surprised at this stuff. It seems like there must be so many bands out there that in order to, you know, tour and get their stuff out there are not necessarily at the level of staying in the Hilton every night. And, you know, sort of rely on staying with other bands, and then those bands stay at your place when they're passing through New York City. You know, it's just kind of like it's an independent little DIY network of people putting out each other's records or booking each other's shows and staying at each other's houses and, you know, sharing contacts for places to play shows. Oh, you got to email this guy in Norwich. He's got a great venue that he can put shows on. And although the last couple of years we have definitely reached a level of success where we do have enough money to stay in hotels, you know, at least half the time, or lately it's been a lot more hotels, which is kind of a shame because you don't meet as many people and you don't really experience the areas in the same way. So we're definitely trying to keep one foot firmly in that DIY world of, you know, being still involved in that network of people. And
I remember when I came to interview you in New York, and I was quite surprised because you said you invited me into your flat and then you let me sleep in your bed. I mean, how often do you let strange journalists sleep in your bed?
Well, I wasn't in the bed at the same time.
Yeah, we should point that out.
Well, I don't know. I mean, as far as strange journalists go, I've met stranger. There's ones I wouldn't let sleep in my bed. Yeah, I don't know. It just made sense. It's well, I don't know. I mean, if you were going to stay there for a week, I might start thinking better of it.
Well, it's very kind of you. Sometimes at your gigs, there's such a shambolic atmosphere going on because it's just you and a guitar, and you're always kind of picking up random things and riffing off certain things that have happened, and that is totally what part of the charm is. Do you sometimes think that you could just be a bit more professional and maybe play the game a bit more? And do you ever wonder?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with the band, my brother and I playing, and with Dave, it's constantly, maybe we should rehearse more, or maybe we should. I mean, and sometimes we have, and it does make a tremendous difference. You know, when you're playing shows every night anyway, that kind of becomes your rehearsal. I mean, maybe the first couple are a little rocky. But then we also hate the idea of being one of those pre-scripted bands where you know, okay, we're going to do this tour. Here's the set list for every night of the tour. Every night, it's sort of like, oh, what are we going to play tonight? What are we going to do? And then even on stage, it's like you sort of have to just go with the flow. And, you know, if you feel like doing one song or another song, or seems like it's so much better to be flexible and figure out what you feel like doing and what would work best at that moment. Even though sometimes that means you shoot yourself in the foot and do things that you aren't really capable of doing, and everybody realizes that you have no idea what you're doing. Other times, everybody realizes you don't know what you're doing, but you're pulling it off anyway. And that's really just astronomically amazing. Like, those are the really magic moments. I do feel like we're one of the best bands on earth. You know, the only thing kind of holding us back is this lack of professionalism where, you know, somebody might say, oh, they did this incredibly amazing thing last night, and then bring 10 friends the next night, and it's just not going to happen again. You know, or we try to make it happen again and it fails terribly. the sort of inconsistency, but that's part of what makes it great for me and makes it great for the people that are into that sort of thing.
I totally agree, and it's total flattery, but I think also the lyrics that you write are some of the best lyrics I've ever heard anyone write. I think they're really funny, really sharp, really clever. I mean, there's a track you've got called Moving, which is on the surface about moving house, but it ends up as kind of a existentialist voyage about life and death and memory and all this stuff.
A place that turned into a friend, return it to how it had been, to become friends with whoever moves in.
And then you've got Williamsburg, Will Oldham Horror, which basically compares the life of an artist to like the difference in the sexes.
On the L train in the morning, I was really sure I saw Will Oldham. He was wearing the same sunglasses he had on stage at the Bowery Ballroom. Had he come to walk among the Williamsburgers of his kingdom? You might say, now there's a guy who seems to have the world laid out before him. Or you might say he's just a rich kid or a fascist or a charlatan. But either way you say it, if you look at indie rock culture, you really can't ignore him. Even if at first dismissive, after some listens, you'll enjoy it.
It's just very smart. I mean, where do you get the ideas from?
I usually don't really know what's going to happen if I start messing around with an instrument or just pen and paper. I mean, sometimes I write stuff and it ends up becoming a comic book, and sometimes it ends up becoming a song, and sometimes it ends up being something fictional, sometimes autobiographical, sometimes, you know, one of the historical pieces. It comes out of that unprofessionalism. I mean, I know so many people that wanted their whole lives to be musicians and be doing all these things that I'm doing, is releasing albums and touring, and they're so much better than me at singing, at playing. But because I'm sort of coming at this from this random angle of, like, I just wanted to be a comic artist and here I am somehow making music, you know, I don't really know where these songs are going to come from, or how to write songs, or why this certain song came out or that song came out. But I don't want to exclude any of it. I mean, if I feel like I write a song and it's, you know, it's this really angry punk song, sure, throw that into the mix too. We'll play that song. Or, you know, if Jack comes up with a song that is just incredibly silly or, you know, scatological, all right, we'll play that one too.
I was wondering what it was like being in New York around 2000, 2001, when the Strokes and Interpol, Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs took off. And also there was a lot of sort of hype around the anti-folk scene, which is where you've come from with Moldy Peaches and bands like that. How exciting was it living in New York?
Well, randomly, despite the fact that of all of, you know, these New York bands, I'm probably the only one, or, well, I can't say I'm the only one, but, I literally grew up right there in the city, and New York is mostly comprised of people that have moved there or come there for university. And, you know, like most cities, it's a great place to leave home and move to.
But you grew up on the Lower East Side as well, didn't you?
Yeah, kind of right in the thick of all of those scenes. It was just it was just kind of what I took for granted as reality, and I missed out on that whole idea of, like, oh, I'm going to leave home and go to the big city and reinvent myself or start a band or get involved in this crazy scene. It's just been my home my whole life. Except, ironically, during that particular year, I was like, well, maybe I should have the experience of leaving home. So I moved to Austin, Texas. And while I was gone, it was like, oh, everybody I knew was getting signed and all this stuff was happening. You know, the Twin Towers collapsed. And, well, I sort of, like, ducked out at, like, the weirdest time. And then
Never leave home again.
Yeah, I was like, man, I can't leave New York for 5 minutes. You miss out on everything. I did end up, obviously, I ended up back there from Austin, Texas. But it was being away that kind of, in a certain way, made me realize how much what I loved about New York and how much New York was in me in a way that I hadn't really realized. Like, being part of the music scene in Austin, Texas, just for the few months that I was there in 2000 and 2001. That was when I got signed to Rough Trade. In 2001, I wasn't even in New York at the time. I just got an email from Jeff Travis. In a certain way, maybe it's better that I wasn't in, you know, maybe he was in New York looking at stuff, and if he had actually seen me in person, he wouldn't have signed it. But because he was in New York and he was like, oh, I've been hearing about this Jeffrey Lewis guy, you know, I wasn't there to screw things up. So, you know, maybe that was for the best.
That's Jeffrey Lewis, and he's on tour around the UK in September, including Cardiff on the 10th, Derby on the 13th, and Manchester and Leeds on the 15th and 16th, respectively. Good job, Tim. All right, back to the blog now, where opinions were divided as to last week's guest, TV on the Radio. Let these two posts serve as an example. First, Davis64. I'm 100% sure that TV on the Radio are one of those bands that, years down the line, people will look back on and think, yeah, those guys knew what they were doing. Those guys were ahead of their time. Those guys were the shit. They are one of the most important, relevant and downright enjoyable bands of the 21st century so far, and I cannot wait for their new album. So yeah, I like the interview. The second post, however, is from L'Australia. I'm 100% sure that TV on the Radio are one of those bands that years down the line, people will look back on and say, what on earth did we ever see in them? Studio Arse are for the unimaginative indie crowd, in my opinion, like. And so on and so on. Though what everyone could agree on was, in the words of World Jam, that when the band started talking about science, they were embarrassingly ill-informed. The idea, says Blunt on, that scientists don't care about mankind's best interests and you have to be a genius to be a scientist is rubbish. It takes hard work and dedication rather than fannying around making art or music. Ooh, ooh, get them. And in some way, music is a type of science itself. Anyway, that's you lot on the blogs. We had a couple of new Facebook friends this week, but not nearly enough for me to read them out. We want more. We promised to tend that page a little bit better this week in return for more friends. We just want to be loved, that's all. Let's now move on to our new section, which is still awaiting a name, but I don't know, we could call it something like Tender and True, being that that's what it is, a delicate revealing of our own personal interest in music. This week, it's the turn of our much-missed Rosie Swash, who is on holiday in China, but took time before she went to record a little bit talking about one of her favourite artists, Terry Callier.
He thinks it's easy to fly. He's just a little bit freer than I. Now here's a mystery.
I can't remember when it was that I first heard Terry Callier's music, but I can remember that it was his truly lovely song Ordinary Joe which first introduced me to him. I loved the sentiment and I loved the bird metaphor throughout the song and I loved his voice. But mostly, I loved that it was jazz, and I don't really do jazz, and yet I couldn't help but love it. But you can't really begin a discussion about Callier without mentioning his defining album What Colour Is Love from 1973. Not only has it got one of the best record sleeves of all time, it's the perfect showcase for Callier's unique and beguiling fusion of jazz, blues, folk and soul, and I haven't stopped listening to it ever since I bought it.
Or deep like a fountain is flowing. What about me? How can you receive?
A dream of mine came true when I got to interview the now 64-year-old musician during his brief stay in London earlier this year. He was here to play Massive Attack's curated Meltdown Festival. He was every bit as charming and mysterious as I imagined him to be, discussing his remarkable life and everything from his childhood friendship with Curtis Mayfield to his United Nations Award for a 1998 song Timepiece, and how he gave it all up to work as a computer programmer at the University of Chicago, where he's from. Callier's back with a new album very soon called Hidden Conversations, and he plays a couple of UK dates this September, which I strongly recommend you attend. In the meantime, I also strongly recommend you give What Colour Is Love some serious attention.
I do declare you're gonna miss your candy man, yeah. I'm keeping you safe and warm, yeah, baby, keeping you out of home.
That's our Rosie on Terry Callier, and you can find his music in all the usual respectable outlets. And I'm afraid that brings us to an end on this week's podcast. Thanks to Tim, thanks to Will Dean, thanks to you lot for listening. We'll be back next Friday, and in between time, you can download or subscribe at guardian.co.uk/music. Make sure you do, because we love you. Until next Friday, bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.